Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And just before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to acknowledge our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Also, I would like to pay my respects to everybody listening around the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service. Big shout out to all the communities, the remote communities that are taking in Let's Talk this morning. Hope all you mob are having a deadly day. On a program with me this morning is a deadly Biripi man by the name of Keenan Mundine. I've got his bio, so I want to read a bit of his bio, I think, which is important and which will paint the picture of our interview this morning. Keenan Mundine is a proud Aboriginal man with connections to the Biripi Nation through his mother, who's from Taree, and ties to the Waka Waka Nation through his father, who's from Cherbourg, up this way, a couple hours from Brisbane. Keenan is the youngest of three boys who grew up in Redfern, New South Wales. Keenan had a rough start to his childhood after losing both his parents at a young age. Sorry to hear about that, brother. Being placed in care separated him from his siblings, and growing up unsupported with negative role models in his life, Keenan faced his own difficulties in life, made some poor decisions in his adolescence, which resulted in a lengthy involvement in the justice system. Keenan is the principal consultant at Inside Outside Aboriginal Justice Consultancy, which is an Aboriginal owned and led consultancy firm dedicated to raising awareness for the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in the criminal justice system and providing expert advice and initiatives, solutions to improving outcomes for Aboriginal people, families and communities. Keenan is currently working on the Street Smart project in the inner city suburb of Glebe, which is an early intervention, prevention and diversion program with young Aboriginal people. Good morning, brother Keenan, and thank you for joining us on program this morning.
Deadly brother, thank you for the phone call, and thank you to all the listeners out there for joining also, brother. And I'd like to acknowledge our traditional custodians of the land that we live on, and yeah, I'm all the way down here in New South Wales, so big shout out to the mob all around the country. So thank you very much.
No, thank you, brother, for joining us, and also for the deadly work that you're doing. It is your bio, younger days, is very, it is a familiar sort of thing when it comes to young Aboriginal people separated from family, separated from culture. There's always this sort of process where young kids are getting in trouble with the justice system. So that was a part of your young life?
That was a big part of my early, teenage years, and man, a big part of my life and a big part of my work, what I do now. So, it is sad to say that it's not, an unfamiliar story within our communities, not just in New South Wales, Queensland and around this country. A lot of brothers and sisters, like you said, go through similar things that I went through, with that disconnection from culture and being, sort of led astray by negative people and not giving them the best information, So that was a big part of my life. And now, the biggest part of my life is working and trying to provide not just my people with a better way forward and a better understanding of the criminal justice system, but also non-Indigenous people to work, with us.
And I guess, the platform that you sort of come from now, knowing both sides of the criminal justice system, being a person who was on the inside, but then also showing avenues to sort of for mob to stay out. Yeah. As a young fella growing up in Redfern, everybody knows Redfern in Australia, very synonymous community. At one point, the hub of black self-determination, where all these organizations that we have today, was birthed out of these places. What was it like for you growing up, I'm guessing late 90s, early 2000s as a youngster?
Man. So I think, the biggest sort of thing to understand at the time when I was a young fella, the community was introduced to heroin. So I got to see firsthand, man, what that does to not just communities, what it does to families and what it does to individuals. And that started, the sort of, trouble that we see. There was a lot of drug and alcohol abuse, man. There was a very, very heavy police presence. I remember seeing police, from as early as I remember patrolling our neighbourhood, arresting uncles and aunties, and, you know, it was just a normal part of our life. Man, you know, just that everyday struggles of being a blackfella, you know, people was charging up everywhere. There wasn't too many sort of positive role models around, and you sort of had to sort of, you know, fend for yourself as a young fella.
So. And also at a young age, you were separated from your family. You was placed in care.
Man, for me, it was a really big sort of shock, you know, because in the space of 3 years, I was a double orphan, and not just losing both of my parents, I lost both of my older siblings.
Oh, yeah, sorry to hear about that, brother.
No, that's all right, man. Yeah. But you know, they at the time, my family, you know, found it really hard to keep the three boys together in the 90s, you know, at that time it was really hard just for Aboriginal people to get jobs and to pay rent. So they found it really difficult not to look after their own immediate family, but us. Mm. So they thought, you know, the best decision to provide us with what we need was to be able to look after us individually and take us on individually. My family and the community and sort of the services at that time weren't knowledgeable to be able to support me and my brother through that process. So yeah,
and this is where you sort of started getting going down the wrong road, and
that's what, yeah,
like it says, you know, yeah, these negative role models in your life.
I think because of the sort of financial situation and the distance between us, there was no emphasis on getting me and my brothers together. Mm. It was more about getting me to school and getting me to football training and doing the little things, and they didn't really try and keep that bond and that connection.
How far separated, like, were you from your siblings?
Man. Not very far, man. Not very far, but, you know, there was a lot going on at the time. Mm. and I think their priorities were elsewhere, and at the same time, you know, they had their own families and their own children, and they had to take on, you know, a 7-year-old boy and a 9 and 10-year-old after losing their mum. So.
Mm. I was watching I was watching your speech at Geneva at the UN. And you opened your speech with saying you remember your first night being locked up, you know, how cold it was.
Yeah.
For our listeners as well, just tell us a bit about, I guess, that experience and, you know, what led you to sort of being behind bars.
So come on, you know, my story, I think about when I started going about year six, year seven, that transition from 12 to 13, you know, is a big time for a young boy. And I started asking a lot of questions. And like I said, no one could sort of support that. And I went on my own journey to find my roots and information that I felt necessary, you know, for my purpose. Unfortunately, I found my brothers, man, and they were affected by the situation, you know, beyond my understanding, and they couldn't be the brothers that I needed them to be. But at that time, there were boys in my community that played that role, you know, that looked after me and took me under their wing. And I think about 14 years old, man, they sort of showed me a whole new world and how to look after myself on the streets. Unfortunately, you know, the skills and the tools they gave me to survive were to break the law and to steal, you know, and that began, man, my long involvement, as you know. About 14, man, I think I got charged for breaking into a car for a laptop.
Mm.
And then, yeah, the experience of going through the system at such a young age, man, and being sort of, yeah, like I said, it was really sort of fast for me, but I still remember it, to be honest, it was very, very, you know, scary, man, and it was really cold, and, you know, I was away from my family, I was away from people that supported me and guided me, and it was one of the scariest sort of things in my life, I think the system sort of not broke me, but I think the system prepared me to come back again.
Mm.
And it sort of, what can I say, man, desensitized me to the whole process and made it become natural.
Mm.
Because all of my older cousins were in there, you know, my brothers were already in the boys' home, you know, my cousins, all the boys that I was on the street with, that I used to go to school with, you know, we were out there, you know, doing you know, silly things, and we're taking care of ourselves, entertaining ourselves, because our homes weren't the safest place to be because of what, you know, was going on in the homes at that time. So we hang out on the street. We had no money for shoes or clothes, and we steal, and, you know, we'd have excess funds, and then we sort of got introduced to drugs and alcohol, man. So I think myself, man, I started drinking and smoking about 14, 15. By the age of 15, when I turned 16, I had like a $3,000 a day heroin habit. So I started smoking heroin because of the older people I was hanging around at that time. So it sort of cemented me deeper in that lifestyle, man, and I started, you know, losing myself and my way, and everything became normal. That, like I said, that process, and everyone around me was either in jail or going to court or coming out of jail or going to jail or running from police or hiding from police. Yeah, that like I said, it's all too familiar, man.
And how long was that process? In and out of jail, you know, committing crime.
I think from my first charge, you know, from 14, I went in and out of the boys' home all the way up until 18 here in New South Wales. I'd do like 4 months, 6 months here, 8 months, you know, for breaking in the cars, stealing cars, breaking in the houses, you know, doing things that I thought, or I was told, you know, it's the only way for me to survive out here because nobody cares about us. And then 18, I went to adult jail. Man, and I spent 3 years on remand here in New South Wales fighting my charges, and I think I ended up doing 4 years, and I got out with 3 years parole, and there was no way I was going to finish it, man. I had no family. I got out after my four-year sentence, brother, no better off than when I went in. I came out homeless. I had no money. I had no job. I had nowhere to stay. I had no food. I had no clothes. I had no way of getting them. I didn't have a bank account. I had no ID. I had no license. So this was 2010, and I got out. I got out 22 years old, 23 in 2010, and I just fell straight back into the trap and ended up back in prison, back in, you know, the cycle again, and I spent another 2.5 years, I think, in, and then I got out in 2012, and I met my current wife now, man, and the mother of my children at a family party. One of my friends, his daughter was turning 18, so he dragged me up to the pub, and I was having a party, and I started talking to this, you know, another black woman in there, and then unfortunately, you know, I was unported, and I fell back into the trap. And because of me and my lengthy involvement with the criminal justice system, and because of my Aboriginality and the people I hang with in prison, I was labelled a high-risk offender. So I went to Goulburn Prison here in New South Wales, which houses, you know, New South Wales' most notorious prisoners, all of the murderers, all of the armed robbers, all of the, like, terrorists and gang leaders here in New South Wales. They all go to Goulburn or Lithgow, and I went down to Goulburn. Man, they house us down there with only the brothers. So I was in the yard with about 11 other brothers, and 5 of them were in for murder. You know, and then I thought to myself, you know, like, just, there's got to be more to this. I never asked for this life, man. I don't want to do this no more. And I had the alternative, man, to do like a rehabilitation sort of, what can I say, drug and alcohol program, in a therapeutic program in prison, which sort of keeps me away from mainstream population. So this jail only sort of has about, in any given time, a maximum of 40 boys in it annually. So they take 10 boys on, and they do it in stages, and it goes stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3, and your first 6 months is in a classroom, in a jail, away from everyone else. And you learn about drugs and alcohol and what they do to you, but then you also learn about your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, and, you know, your journey, where you come from, how they influence you, how they make you make decisions, how, you know, your community, your surroundings. And then the stage 2 is, once you're successful and you're drug free, you know, and you don't get in any trouble in jail, they put a bracelet on your brother and they let you come back to your family in the community, and you got to go back to the jail at night. And I started, you know, being supported by my now wife and coming back to the community, man, and getting connected with my back, coming back to Redfern, seeing my family, man. I started playing football again, you know, started doing all of these things that kept me off the street. And then I got to stage three. And to tell you a little bit more about the program and sort of how real the cycle and the system is, that 10 boys came into stage one with me. I think six of us went to stage two, and I think four of us went to stage three, which means we lived in the community and I lived at home, but I still had to abide by the jail rules, mm-hmm. where I'd have to go and be urined and drug tested. I'd go to court every fortnight and tell them my progress, what I'm up to. Two of them have, got within a week of coming home to stage three, two of them overdosed and died.
Far out.
So there's only like two of us left now that have actually completed that program out of my class that are in the community. Mm-hmm. The other three or four of them are still trapped in the cycle. I think a couple of them got done doing armed robbing that. So.
Okay, like I guess stage one then, you get introduced to this program.
Yeah.
You heard about stage three. You know, getting out and doing, you know, having an ankle bracelet and doing these visits to the courthouse. What's your thought during stage one, thinking, is this going to work? Or, you know, like you felt that it's always been yourself and on your own. And then, like, you enter stage one, brother. Tell us a bit about that.
Like, for me, brother, because you need to understand, man, I turned 31 the other day. I might cry, but it's because I'm happy and, you know, I have these thoughts when I'd be interviewed or have a yarn, you know, on the run. So, man, I turned 31 the other day, and I think my wife has been the only sort of consistent person in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've been with her since 2012, man. You know, besides my brothers, before my mum and dad passed away, no one stayed sort of consistently in my life for more than 2 or 3 years. They'd come, they go, I'd go, I'd travel, you know, I'd get locked up, I'd do my thing. So nobody sort of influenced me and sort of got me to understand the world. It was touch and go by myself, and I figured it all out on my own, man. I got to stage one, and I think for me, I sort of wanted a different life, but being a brother and being from where we come from and the communities we come from and being in the situations I've been in and doing the stuff that I've done, man, nobody makes it out. So me being there, I didn't know what out looked like. I just wanted my own out.
You know, it's all good, brother. Take a second there, you know, and also, you know, never be ashamed or apologize, you know, to
get upset or cry,
brother.
I'll never be ashamed, brother. I want everybody to know, you know, my story and the reason why I tell it, brother.
Yeah.
They need to know. It's not fun and games, man. It's no place for us, and they take your soul in there, man, and so I didn't really know what out looked like. So for me, going to the program, I just wanted a safe place, man. I didn't want to come back to the community and, you know, not trust anyone, not have to run, duck, hide, lie, dodge, steal. You know, I was very tired of running and running from the police and being the tough guy and putting that front on that nothing hurt me and nothing can hurt me. I just wanted somewhere safe to go, man. I think so. When I got to stage one, I just wanted to take it one day at a time, man, because I had a criminal record. I didn't know anyone besides out of my brothers who got out of jail and got a job and got a house. So I was taking this on the first time, but I knew, you know, I had the support of this new girl. You know, she had a job, she was studying, she had a head screwed on, so I knew she could support me in ways that, you know, I could never believe and never believe that I'd get here.
Yeah, deadly.
But it was challenging everything that I was taught to survive. My whole fiber in me that you know, no one can make it out of this system, and the only way out of my community is to get back out and rob the next bank and make it, you know, big getaway or something silly like that, you know. And that's what happens when you go into jail. People just tell silly stories like that, and brothers don't talk about their community. They don't talk about their family. They don't talk about their kids. They don't talk about their mob. You know, they just, got this front, man. And so I got to stage one, and my plan for me, cuz, was, you know, to take it one day at a time, get to stage three, and just stay off the streets, stay at home, and take it one day at a time.
Yeah, definitely.
also, it also, you know, taught me a lot about why I think and feel the way I do because of the places I'm in.
Yeah.
So I started removing myself from them situations that made me feel a certain type of way. I started, you know, assessing and learning about the friends that I have. Are they good for me or are they bad for me? You know, even if they're my blood, are they good for me or are they bad for me? You know, I started putting myself first and I guess, you know, man, just taking it one day at a time. Nobody, like I said, nobody from Redfern or none of the brothers I knew went to jail and was as deep in the game as I was and got out of it. And so I didn't know what out looked like.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, so for me, just being there, man, it was a big success. I was sort of away from mainstream jail and all the brothers that sort of influenced me. And, being around older people and being around people that, you know, I respected, man, if they had a certain type of view, I had to take it on too, you know.
Mm.
That's my people. So, so being away from that, I got to focus a lot on myself. I got to learn a lot about myself. I got to learn a lot about, like I said, you know, my community and how it influences me and how it makes me feel and act, where I want to be, how I'm going to get there.
Yeah. And if you've just tuned in to 98.9 FM, my guest is Keenan Mundine. Keenan Mundine is a proud Biripi man. His mum's from Taree. His dad's from Cherbourg. He's grown up in Redfern. He still lives down there in Sydney. We've been yarning about his life, him growing up, being incarcerated as a juvenile and also as an adult, and how he turned his life around. I'm just going to head to a quick song break, and this song I'm going to play is Brisbane Blacks by Mopping the Dropouts.
Rose Birram with Let's Talk.
We're back on Let's Talk. That was Brisbane Blacks by Mop and a Dropout, and that was requested from Brother Keenan for his old man. He was a proud Cherbourg man up this way. You know, Cherbourg's a couple of hours away from Brisbane. Strong black community just north of Brisbane. But, brother, I want to yarn to you now also about before the break, we were yarning about these three phases, this program that you did inside about, you know, getting released and identifying drug issues and the health issues that they cause.
Yeah.
Phase three, you know, like you're out. I guess you've sort of just got to transform not your identity, but I guess the stuff that you've learnt growing up. How, like, that must have been a difficult task, you know, relearning about yourself and the things that you can do outside of, I guess, committing crime and staying clean and stuff. Like, how was that part? How hard was it? I think
for me, man, it was hard because I was used to really taking care of myself, and I knew, like, if I had no money, I could go and do something illegal and get money and take care of myself. So what I started doing was, why was I, you know, doing what I was doing? It was to take care of myself. So I'd make sure that I had food at home. I'd make sure I had money to get to where I need to get to, you know, plan my week out. And I think filling it up with meaningful activities, man. So I started playing footy again. So that was my Tuesday and Thursday, taking up the footy training, and Sunday for footy. I started volunteering as a youth worker and studying. So my week was sort of taken up. And then I guess it was just, you know, really being on the ball about, you know, go, like, man, how am I going to get to where I'm going to get to? Having a sort of a plan. I had a little 6-month plan and a little 12-month plan, you know, and that was just to get out of jail and stay out, take it one day at a time, and challenge myself to get a job. You know, and after, man, 6 months of playing footy and just taking it one day at a time, man, and studying and coming home, I loved my food coming from jail, man. So I taught myself how to cook. So I would come home and cook myself deadly feeds every night, you know, and I'd spoil myself, and I'd sort of take the time out for me. I'd put myself first. I'd go in, I'd see my family in Redfern, you know, I'd say, you know, hello, I'd pop in, I'd have a seat, I'd do what I'd do, but I'd always, you know, leave and come home, because I know if I stay there, like, I just know, man, my 6 months plan, I need to be, you know, on the ball and stay. I think the biggest question was, if I could go to jail and work in prison for, like, man, $1 a day, why can't I do it out here? So I sort of took that approach.
Was there much expectation of you reoffending and going back in from other people and from court or from police and stuff? Was it like,
the biggest thing to understand that every sort of system here, an assessment tool, they assess risk here. I was always medium to high risk, which meant I was never going to break the cycle, and I would always reoffend and come back to prison, you know, within 3 to 6 months because of, you know, my I don't have a home, I don't have any job skills, I don't have any family support, and that's how they measured it. They don't help me. The system, you know, that assessed me with all of this risk and labelled me all of these certain type of ways, then put no sort of support structures in place. They basically said, here's Keenan, he's a high risk, he's going to re-offend again, you know, it's up to you guys to basically fix him. We've assessed him. So now, you know what I mean? Now the consultancy work that I do is basically say, you know, don't let that sort of system get to you just because they put you down. You know, I've been given many labels, my brother, and I've broken them all, and I've shown them that, you know, these systems mean nothing. It's just a measurement of their risk. That's all it is.
When did it dawn upon you that, you know, your experience that you had growing up as a young black man, you could sort of transfer your knowledge into, you know, keeping other young black fellas sort of that are at risk of going inside, from actually going inside? When did you when did you have that moment? And was that something you always had? Was like, oh, I always want to be somebody that supports my community?
No, I think, man, I just think, so part of my condition was to do counselling, and I was counselling at a youth centre, and I guess there was some young fellas hanging around there that were a bit unapproachable. This is what I've got told at the end. So they were going there and, you know, they were getting no answers or information out of these kids. They were walking into the centre using the facilities, toilets, making feed, whatever, but they'd get nothing out of them. And then I went there and I was doing my counselling. I started actually having a yarn to them and, you know, finding out where they're from and who their family are. And they basically told me that the kids had been there for 6 months and haven't said more than hi or where's the toilet or is there any drink or any food. So they said to me, you know, have I ever thought about being a youth worker? You know, kids respond to you. So I think that was, for me, I always wanted, you know, I always played a bit of a role in jail, I guess, taking young boys in and teaching them the ropes and, you know, trying to get them to stay out of trouble. So I had it in me and I never, ever wanted anybody sort of to experience some of the things that I've experienced. That's why I want to give them the skills and the tools to make better decisions. And then from there, man, I was already studying youth work, and then that sort of cemented it for me. I got a job and I started working as a youth worker, man, one day a week for 6 hours. You know, because they understood my position and they understood what was going on around me, and they didn't want to give me too much, and they didn't want to give me too much sort of responsibility or pressure. And I took that, like I said, one day at a time, brother, and I smashed it out of the park. I turned the one day a week into like 2 days a week, into 3 days a week, into 4 days a week, into two different roles in the organization. So, you know, I think my work ethic and also knowing, brother, where rock bottom is. So if I don't get up and go to work and do the right thing, I'm going to have to go and do the wrong thing.
And now, like, you're in this really, really deadly position where you get to make these programs or, you know, do these programs, you know, to talk to these young fellas about your life and, you know, about what they could expect if they still go down that road. I guess, why is it important for yourself to sort of be in this position where you can be a mouthpiece to these young fellas that are, you know, not really being heard or seen? Why is it important to know their stories and your stories?
I feel it's important to know the story because for me, coming through the system, and I guess some of the supports that are put in place are put in place by people that have never experienced and or have been through whatever type of support you're looking for. So I'm a big advocate for people with lived experience involved in creating whatever support services out there, whatever you're trying to help. And for me, man, it's also highlighting the sort of lack of understanding of people coming, you know, from different types of homes, different types of support structures and financial backgrounds. So getting me, you know, and people, and my voice is at the forefront of these conversations, man. It gets people at the core of the issue and the most affected by them, you know, to understand how to support them. Even if they're not at the level I'm at to give you ways to help them, you can then hear it firsthand coming, you know, from the grassroots, what's happening. There's no disconnect. There's no second or third, you know, third word. It's coming, you know, straight from the problem.
And you're listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM. I'm your host, Bo Spearham, and my guest on the program is Keenan Mundine. We're going to play the song Black Boy by Coloured Stone.
call him Black Boy. He oddly talked to the girls and boys. Don't be a fool, just obey the rules, 'cause you'll just learn the truth. Black Boy,
Black Boy,
Black Boy,
Black Boy.
The color of your skin is your pride and joy.
And that was Black Boy by Coloured Stone. Such a deadly song that is. They were actually here in Brisbane a few weeks ago for the NAIDOC celebrations. They'd done a few shows in Brisbane. Got to see my NAIDOC. They were deadly as always. You know, Bunalori and all their mob have not lost a touch. They just kill it every time. But I've been yarning with Keenan Mundine, Biripi man, about his life and about the work that he's doing now. For our listeners, brother, what's the type of work that you're doing right now? You know, like earlier in the program, we yarned about the type of work you did that landed you behind bars and which sort of brought you to here where you are today. Like, what's some of the work that you're doing today?
I have a very, very sort of, you know, diverse knowledge, man, but I run my own consultancy, as you read at the start. I just secured a contract with an adult jail facility here in New South Wales, which is the first of its kind, where they've actually hired an ex-offender directly to come back in and provide a service. Mm-hmm. So I got hired to go back in and deliver a yarn and circle for the boys, and I'm going to be going back in there, you know, to support the boys and talk about some of these issues around family and community and supporting them when they come out.
Mm-hmm.
I've also secured a contract with a national organisation that works with young people in the criminal justice system called Shrine for Kids, and I use my knowledge and my lived experience and my expertise how to, you know, enhance their program and to deliver it more culturally and more culturally competent and safe, you know, from a lived experience point of view. I advocate and I lobby, you know, local, state, federal and government. I have very, very busy. I'm also a husband and a father of two boys. So I'm really, really busy and very, very fortunate now to have the work that I do, brother.
When you first walked out of prison, did you ever think that you'd walk back in and in a sort of capacity that you walk that you have now?
Never in my life, you know, before I met this girl, and it's sad to say in any many forums I say it, like I said, coming from the community I come from, I accepted my life, brother. I accepted that my life is going to be nothing but crime, drugs and jail. I accepted it because that's all my brothers are around to me, you know, that are in jail. All my brothers before me went to jail, or they all but died, or, you know, nobody makes it out. So let's just be in the struggle and let's just kick along with it. You know, no more feeling sorry for myself. It is what it is. So I never thought of a life beyond the one I was living. And that was jail and drugs and crime, man.
Mm. Now you're a father of two, like you just said, of two young boys. What's it like to be a dad? And
for me, you know, it's very, very emotional because I didn't have an experience of a father. So I'm learning as I go, and I never had any sort of strong father role models around me long enough to influence me on how to be a father or a man. So I'm learning on the run. But for me, man, it's being proud and seeing, you know, the fruits of my labor I can't believe I have my own family and, you know, I have my own home. You know, I live in my own home for my own family. People who, you know, sort of understand the nuances or what I'm talking about. I lived in a house, but it was never a home. Brother, you know, some people out there will understand that. But this is my home. I come home to it every night. I'm sort of proud to live here. You know, it's not the... I stay on top of it. I pay my rent. I've been out of jail for nearly 4 years now. I haven't been pulled over by police. I haven't been looked at. I've met the Prime Minister. I've had the Prime Minister to myself. You know, I just went to Switzerland to deliver the speech as we discussed. I finished parole for the first time in my life. I finished a justice order, which was, you know, me coming out of that program, which I was talking about. So I finished that stage one, stage two, stage three, which went for 6 months. So 18 months all up. I had 2.5 years parole. I just finished that. And I just left the country for the first time before going to Geneva with my family, brother. So I went to Vanuatu on a holiday earlier this year, just after finishing my parole. And, you know, man, I think for me being a father, it's also a bit scary because I know the big bad world, like I know. So I'm very hyper vigilant and I'm sort of a bit too much, you know, when I'm out, you know, where's the boys, what's going on, how are they, what's going on.
And I guess just in wrapping up, brother, where you are now, you sort of have two types of generations that, you know two sides of you. You know, you have you know, your past life, that family members, friends that would have known you, but then also younger fellows and also other older people today that sort of know the side of you with the deadly work that you're doing now. What's it like, I guess, when you see them old fellows and then when you, you know, I guess in your old days to seeing, you know, and to meeting new people, to sort of only knowing you as a person that's going into juvies, that's going into prisons and doing this stuff for our mob?
Yeah. For me, man, I'm really, really, really proud of who I am. And I think the reason why I do what I do and I go through my story and I go through my emotions open, live and proud is to show our mob, man. We are the oldest living culture here, you know. Man, my bloodlines and your bloodlines will go back 80,000 years, man, and that's proven. So we are the rightful owners of this land and, you know, I want to give this to my kids and I want them, you know, to be proud of me and to remember me as a good man and not be forgotten, man.
Nah, you won't be forgotten, brother. That's for sure. You know, when your kids get older and realize, you know, the work that you're doing now with the community, I realize, you know, what daddy man you are. Just in wrapping up, brother, any inspiring words for younger fellas that are right now going through that? What you've been through, and trying to, you know, get on that steady road.
Man, I think the biggest one, man, is talking about what's going on because nobody can give you the help you need if you're not truly honest with yourself and your family and your people. In whatever situation you're in, be honest. And if you can't be honest with them, man, I think they're not meant to be in your life. If you can't tell them deep down what's going on, I think at the same time, man, you know, we have the strength and the resilience to accomplish whatever we want with hard work and determination. Mm. I know, you know, I had a lot of support, but, man, anything anyone wants to achieve, man, with hard work and dedication, then our people can you know, lower these steps and make the life they want. I think for me, I live my life today as the life I wanted as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So,
brother,
a lot. Yeah, that says a lot, man.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. It does. And, like, throughout this interview, you've mentioned countless times about your partner and the role that she played How important is she, Barry?
Man, she's my rock, man. You know, just goes to show how strong, you know, our women are and deadly black women are. So my wife is a Wiradjuri woman and she's the first woman of her descendants to ever get a scholarship from university. And she's, got a master's in criminology and she's worked in the community sector with me. So she's a very, very strong, knowledgeable woman and they hold the fort down and, man, they support us through thick and thin and, you know, they'll hold us down no matter what. So love our women and treat our women with respect and they're our queens and princesses of the future, man. So she means a lot to me. Yeah. You know, these kids and these people need people like us to love them like they're our own, because I feel like they're in the situation they're in because they're not getting the love, support, care and guidance they need. You know, so don't judge anyone by their cover or their past and don't ever hold any boundaries on yourself. I think for me, man, the biggest quote was, you know, there's no passion settling for a life less than the one you're capable of living, man. So that just means don't settle, you know. You don't have to stay on the mission. You don't have to stay on the block. You don't have to stay in the neighborhood. Go out, explore the world, live your life, love your family. You only get one shot at it, man, and be true to yourself.
Now, a big thank you for joining us in the program, my brother.
Deadly,
and it's
brother.
Really, really deadly work, brother, that you're doing.
Thank you,
and,
thank you.
It's an honor to have this yarn with you.
No worries. So I think the biggest thing is what I said, brother. So thank you for calling me and getting in touch. You know, you can see what the work that I do on Facebook. You can follow my name, Keenan Mundy. My business page, Inside Out, AJC. And the actual program that I work on is Street Smart, and the page is Street Industry. I'm also on Twitter.
Yep.
You know, you can see the work that I do and follow me, and let's change the narrative of our people, man, because we are strong, we are resilient people, and we deserve more. This is, you know, our country, this is our home, and these are our children, and it's our future.
Deadly. Thanks, my brother. And if you've been listening to Let's Talk, I've been yarning with Keenan Mundine, proud Biripi man and also Waka Waka man as well. We've been yarning about his life and also the deadly work that he's been doing as of late. If you'd like to listen to the repeat of this program, you can tune in at 7 p.m. tonight on 98.9 FM, or you can go to our podcast, or you can go to our website and listen to our podcast at 98.9fm.com.au.